in Europe, in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in Sweden recently, they were talking about fighting Russia. When it comes to this kind of mindset, in your opinion, what's the reason behind this type of thinking in Europe?
I think there are probably two main factors driving this. First is a lack of confidence in the United States with President Trump about to apparently stage a comeback. The commitment to defend Europe against Russia or other potential enemies is somewhat questionable. Every country in Europe seems to me to be hedging against this possible loss of American support. And second, if you want to boost your defense spending, which, for example, Germany is trying to do, then you need to have a designated enemy. So this is politically mobilizing to designate Russia as a threat. In the case of Germany, of course, the relationship with Russia is very complex. For many, many years, Russia and Germany were odd, before World War II, were the odd countries out in Europe, both isolated and ignored in the councils of Europe, and they actually cooperated. The military buildup that Adolf Hitler pulled off in Germany was supported by the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin. And so there is a recognition, I think, historically, in both Moscow and Berlin, that the two have some kind of organic relationship. They're either friends or they're cooperating or they're enemies. And of course, the border of Germany, defense perimeter, if you will, has been pushed quite far east now. Germany was the frontline country during the Cold War, now it isn't. So if you want to boost defense spending, you've got to come up with a political argument that is appealing. And at the moment, that argument has to do with Russia. It's much better to talk about Russia than to talk about how the United States might let you down. And that, I think that explains some of the rhetoric by Pistorius and others in Germany. As far as the Swedes are concerned, they've just joined NATO. And I think they are also looking for a justification for continued high levels of defense spending. So I think this is partly political and expedient.
Here comes the question, why Europe is the way that we are witnessing right now? Why they cannot be a powerhouse in that region? Why they have to be partner with Russia or the United States? Why they cannot be independent, in your opinion?
Well, I think most Americans, certainly of my generation, hoped that Europe would emerge as a separate power center. And we're very much in favor of the European Union experiment. But it has turned out, if I may use an example from the history of the United States, it's turned out to be like the Articles of Confederation, which followed our victory in the War of Independence with Britain, very ineffectual. Really not producing a sufficiently centralized or coordinated government for the entire country. And so we replaced that with a federal, so this confederal system with a federal system. Europe has not done that. Europe remains very much less than the whole, than the sum of its parts. Many countries in Europe have different visions of the world and their role in it. And we can see this with the approach now to the war in Ukraine, with Hungary and Slovakia and others taking quite a different position than, let's say, France or Germany. So I think Europeans need to get their act together, and they haven't done it. Therefore, they are exercise much less power and influence in the world than they should.
You know that recently the leader of AfD, Alternative for Germany, he said that they're thinking of Dexit. It comes from Brexit in Germany, for Germany. How do you see the changes right now? Do you think this kind of thinking, this kind of mindset is serious right now in Europe?
Well, the British began this with Brexit, which was a very foolish thing to do. It has greatly diminished the British role in the world in many respects. Britain had been the primary agent of influence or representative, if you will, of the transatlantic Anglo-American partnership within the EU. It has lost that role. It was able to leverage its influence on the European continent to have far greater influence outside Europe than it would otherwise have had. It's now been reduced to a relatively small and not very powerful country with many memories of a glorious empire behind it. Germany would be greatly diminished if it were to try to leave Europe. And one thing that the Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, seems to forget is that one of the reasons that Europeans have wanted the United States to remain in NATO and is because a very large Germany is, when the US is in NATO, is not a threat to the other countries. An independent Germany would risk the return of enmity between itself and, let's say, the Poland, which is now a very powerful country, or France, which was an historic enemy of Germany. And the Italians might be heard from as well. So I think this idea is very dangerous. And of course, we have seen in the case of the UK that leaving the EU actually bolsters separatist tendencies on the part of Scotland or Northern Ireland. The Spanish are very afraid of what might happen in Catalonia or the Basque country. Europe could break up into a series of even smaller nation states, which would diminish its role internationally as well as reduce its prosperity. I mean, the fact that Europeans have had a common structure and the ability to move throughout the entire European region has been a major force for boosting European prosperity. And if it were to go away, national borders were to be reestablished, if the common currency were to be abolished, I think this would be very bad for Europe.
We've seen Russia in these 19 months of war in Ukraine. They didn't even cross the Dnieper River in Ukraine. And why they're thinking it can be possible to march toward Europe?
Well, I think it's very unrealistic, which is why I believe it's essentially political rhetoric designed to boost defense spending. And you're quite right. On the one hand, Russian objectives in Ukraine have been quite limited. They have been clearly stated by President Vladimir Putin, and they are basically the neutralization of Ukraine, the protection of Russian speakers within Ukraine in one way or another, and the end of the restriction of foreign presence in Ukraine that threatens Russia. These are the objectives. I don't think. Therefore, it's not that Russia perhaps couldn't cross the Dnieper. It hasn't chosen to. It has not put the manpower into Ukraine that would enable it to do that. It is, however, about to go, apparently, on the offensive after having been on the defensive against the Ukrainian so-called counteroffensive, which failed. It is apparently on the march pretty widely across the entire dividing lines between the two forces. And Ukraine is out of manpower, and its international support is decaying. The US Congress is, as usual, ineffectual in reaching a decision, and the United States is quite divided internally now about whether to continue the support for Ukraine. So I think we've seen, to go back to your basic point, we have seen that Russian capabilities are quite limited. But we also, if we're realistic, we would have to say Russian ambitions are quite limited. They're not the conquest of Western Europe or Central Europe or even Eastern Europe. And I think, you know, if you listen to some unpopular politicians in Europe, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, I think he understands the limitations of Russian ambitions and capabilities very well. And he's not following this line of alarmist line that you hear now from Defense Minister Pistorius and others in Germany.
Protests, these strikes in Europe, they're not happy with their economy. If you were to advise them, what would you say to them?
Well, one has to begin by noting that the destruction of Nord Stream and the end of cheap Russian energy exports to Germany has produced a deindustrialization of Germany. The German economy is declining. It had depended heavily on cheap energy from the East. One thing that Europe has got to do is reestablish an organic relationship with Russia. The United States does not have to have such a relationship. We have our own sphere. Europe, however, Russia is part of Europe. It has to be part of the governing councils of Europe, and it has to be part of the European economy. Now, restoring that is going to be very difficult because the sanctions that have been put on Russia, which have failed to produce the intended result, have reoriented the Russian economy toward the East and South. Russia is now heavily dependent economically on China. It has turned to the Middle East and Africa, and it's turned away from Europe. So the 300-year process by which began with the Russian emperor years ago, the 300-year process of Russia trying to Europeanize itself has ended. The same is true, by the way, of Turkey. It has turned away from the effort to Europeanize itself and is looking now east and south. So I think restoring an organic European relationship with Russia, which is essential to European prosperity, is going to be very difficult. And even if you didn't have the ill will that has been created by, quite a ferocious information war, both on the part of the West and the part of the Russians, which has generated a lot of hatred and suspicion. But I don't think it's possible for Europe to be what it could be if it has no decent relationship with the vast land to its east that Russia is.
You said that Russia had some limited ambitions in Ukraine. Has Putin achieved those limited ambitions, those limited objectives?
Well, that's the real question now. You know, it's always possible to move the goalposts in the game. I think his objectives initially were quite clear, and he has stuck to them. But it's an open question now whether, given the unwillingness of Ukraine to discuss peace and its leadership's intention to avoid negotiations and fight on, it's an open question whether Mr. Putin may now not want to take Odessa, for example, and deprive Ukraine of access to the Black Sea, make it a truncated, much reduced territory, neutralized under the, and maybe part of the European Union, but not part of NATO. One thing is clear, and that is Russia's demonstrated that it will fight to prevent Ukraine going into NATO. So brave talk about Ukraine going into NATO is simply unrealistic. Well, what is Mr. Putin going to be satisfied with? Odessa was traditionally a Russian city. It was founded by Catherine the Great. It has a very large Russian-speaking population. I suspect many of them are in fact loyal to Ukraine rather than Russia at this point. But Mr. Putin may not see that. And so I don't know what will satisfy him. At the moment, since there is no negotiation in prospect, He is left with the only option of imposing a solution by force. Solution B, we don't know. He may not know. Certainly Mr. Zelensky doesn't know. And there is chaos in Kyiv now with infighting between Zaluzhny, the outgoing commander of the Ukrainian armed forces, and President Zelensky, and quite a bit of dissidents, not unity, and no clear strategy. So I don't know where this is going.
When you look at the recent trip of Victoria Nuland to Kiev, what's your understanding of this trip? It seems that she was trying to solve the problems between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, or is it something beyond that, in your opinion?
I fear it may have been something beyond that, and that is reflected in an apparent shift by Mr. Zelensky and the Ukrainians away from the battleground in Ukraine and into long-distance strikes at Russia. The only effect is, you know, Ms. Nuland has been very clear from the beginning. Her objective has been to punish Russia, to harm Russia, to weaken it, to isolate it, not to protect Ukraine, although her ancestry is Ukrainian. You would think she might have some feeling for the Ukrainians, but apparently not. She's interested in punishing Russia. The danger of that is that the Russians will counter-escalate. Any strike deep into Russia will be answered, as we have seen, with intensified strikes at Ukrainian infrastructure and the deindustrialization of Ukraine. So this is a very dangerous game, even if you don't consider the possibility that the escalation could spill out of Ukraine and Russia and involve a more direct conflict between Russia and the United States and NATO.
When you look at Putin's attitude in this conflict in Ukraine, he was talking about negotiations. Lavrov was talking about negotiations, but we don't see anything coming out of the Biden administration regarding that. And you talk about the importance of Odessa for Ukraine. Do you think that in the Biden administration, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, Antony Blinken, are they thinking of importance of Odessa for Ukraine, or they're willing to sacrifice all of Ukraine just to hurt Russia?
Well, I'll make two comments. First, the Biden administration has been very consistent in rejecting negotiations with Russia. This war began when Russia demanded negotiations about the neutralization of Ukraine and some sort of security architecture in Europe that would not threaten Russia or others. And this was directly rejected by Mr. Blinken on behalf of the Biden administration. He continues to reject negotiations. This is an odd position for a foreign minister to take, I would say. It's a very militaristic position to take. When the rejection occurred, when we rejected negotiations, Putin showed that he was serious by invading Ukraine. And we have been caught in this ever since. You remember that within 5 weeks after the invasion, with Turkish and Israeli mediation, Ukraine and Russia reached an agreement. A treaty was drafted, initialed by both sides, and then the Ukrainians, Mr. Zelensky, was persuaded to repudiate the treaty. And a scheduled meeting that he had worked out with Mr. Putin to talk to him directly was canceled. And we've been in a purely military situation ever since. So I think at this point, what is clear is that if there is a negotiation, Russia's bargaining position is vastly stronger than it was in 2022. If Mr. Trump is elected, he said he will end the war in Ukraine right away, and he'll have to do it on Russian terms. There will be no alternative. So this is going to end up very likely as a major defeat for the United States and for American allies in Europe who've gone along with this diplomacy-free statecraft that we practice.
if the US government illegally confiscates $300 billion in Russian assets, send it to Ukraine, what would be the message that they would send to China, to India, to other countries?
Well, the basic responsibility of any banker, including any central banker, is a fiduciary responsibility. The responsibility to protect the deposits of the depositors, not to confiscate them, not to divert them to some other purpose, not to take them and use them to hurt the depositor. So I think that actually doing what some advocate, namely taking the $300 billion in Russian reserves and transferring them to Ukraine for reconstruction of Ukraine, would very likely produce a financial crisis that would end the dominance of the US dollar internationally, and very likely the euro as well, leaving only other currencies to be the backbone of the global economy. It would be devastating. And the effect on my own country would be huge, because we benefit enormously from the hegemony of the dollar. We are able to pay for our imports by printing little green portraits of dead presidents on paper and not producing anything. And this is quite remarkable. We would lose that ability. So I think this is flirting with a real disaster. And I note that the Europeans don't seem very enthusiastic about it. What they are proposing basically is to take the interest on these sequestered reserves of Russia and use that for various purposes to aid Ukraine. Well, that is also not legal, but it is at least not quite as dangerous as the American proposal to take it all and turn it over to Ukraine is.
Recently, Japan and Germany signed a military pact aimed at containing China. Why they're doing this?
My understanding is that this is quite a limited agreement, and it is essentially aimed at facilitating logistical cooperation. In a sense, therefore, it is a German response to the American urging that Europe take more of a role in East Asian security. It's ironic, of course, that the two World War II allies, Germany and Japan, should be getting together again with American support. This is rather strange. But I think the limitations of this are quite clear. It's not an alliance. It's not necessarily directed purely at China. It is aimed at facilitating German operations in East Asia, if they become necessary and appropriate. And Japan, of course, is coming out of its shell. It, like Germany, is trying to double its defense budget. This is in part hedging against the dependence on the United States and taking on a greater role in Japan's own self-defense. And this might involve in the future some sort of Japanese presence in Europe. We don't know. After all, from Japan's point of view, Russia is an active enemy. China is not, but both are problematic. And so I think one shouldn't overinterpret this. I think it is quite limited. It is fairly common these days for countries to reach such agreements for mutual support, that is the procurement of goods locally, the transfer of military equipment on an expedited basis, and so forth. And I think that's what this is about.
But when it comes to the consequences of these kind of treaties, these kind of deals, when it comes to this partnership of China and Russia, do you see these kind of acts gonna bring them even closer?
Well, it certainly adds to the pressure for them to cooperate, which is very foolish on the part of others. Usually the principle of statecraft is you try to divide your adversaries. You don't try to push them together. But that is what we have done. We have given China and Russia every incentive to cooperate against us. And I suppose Germany and Japan are looking at this cooperation in that light. That is, China and Russia are cooperating. Therefore, the countries on either side of China and Russia must cooperate. This is, again, very ironic, going back to geopolitical arrangements that World War II began with.
The United States and United Kingdom are doing some sort of operation in the Red Sea against Houthis. They were asking China to help them in this conflict. They were asking China to talk to Iran, Iran talking to Houthis, increasing the tensions in Taiwan right now with Japan. How they can expect China to help them in the Red Sea?
Well, quite aside from that, I think China's been very outspoken in favor of a ceasefire in Gaza. The Houthis, or more accurately, the unrecognized government in Sana'a in Yemen, the Ansar Allah, it's called, they have been conducting the world's first land-based sea blockade of Israel and Israel's allies. And they have linked this directly to halting the genocide in Gaza. So the Western press continuously does two things which are very misleading. One, they don't state the purpose of the Houthi blockade. They imply that the Houthis are just pirates doing this for the hell of it, or for fun or something, and that they're not serious about supporting Palestinians in Gaza. That is a mistake. The second thing they do is they say the Iranian-aligned, Iranian-supported Houthis, as though Iran has some kind of genius sitting in Tehran who decides what the Houthis will do. But the Houthis are very independent-minded. They do what they want to do, just as, you know, the United States gives money and weapons to Israel, and Israel does whatever it wants. It doesn't pay any attention to what the United States wants. So I think there's a great mistake. People look at Hezbollah, they look at Hamas, they look at the Ansar Allah in Yemen, they look at these various axis of resistance groups in Iraq, and they assume that these are all pawns of Tehran. Yes, they're supported by Tehran. No, they do not take orders from Tehran. And so that is all wrong. And finally, I'll just note that, you know, it's particularly pathetic to go to the Chinese on this when the Chinese, Russians, and Iranians are about to have a naval exercise, joint naval exercise near the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has the capability, if there is a war, to shut down the world's oil supply. If the Houthis can run a land-based sea blockade, Iran is in an even better position to do that. So this is very foolish and raises risks that need not be risked. And it, frankly, attacking Iranian aligned installations or bases in third countries is based on nothing except the theory that somehow Iran is in charge of everything in the region. Iran is a great regional power, yes. Iran has much influence. Iran is able to counsel Hezbollah, Nasrallah, or the Houthis, or forces in Iraq, or the Assad government in Syria. Yes, it can do that. But they're under no obligation to follow orders, and they don't. So we are proceeding on the basis of a very misguided interpretation of regional realities, I think.
It seems that Israelis have agreed on having a ceasefire in Gaza. Do you see this as a result of the Biden administration forcing the Netanyahu administration to do that, or the result of the operation that was not successful on the part of Israelis?
Well, there's been a negotiation going on in which Secretary of State Blinken has involved himself, mediation by Qatar and Egypt between Hamas and Israel. Hamas has published the terms of its release of hostages, a three-part proposal, 45 days each, total of 135 days, in which it would release hostages in return for a ceasefire, complete ceasefire, withdrawal of most Israeli ground forces from Gaza, the end to overflight, the end to aerial surveillance of Gaza, and the restoration of aid through UNRWA to Gazan civilization. Gazan civilians. Netanyahu has abruptly rejected this. So there's no ceasefire in prospect. Mr. Netanyahu remains determined, as apparently most Israelis are, to depopulate Gaza, to annihilate Hamas as part of that depopulation, to annex Gaza, and to resettle it with Jewish settlers. This is an uncompromising position, which means that Israel is in total defiance of the World Court's rulings and of global opinion. And I think it's doing huge damage to Israel's global reputation, and because of the association of the United States with Israel, to us, to the American reputation. We have very little credibility at this point in the region or globally on issues related to human rights, the rule of law, international law, the UN Charter, or the international system which we helped to create after World War II.
How did you see the decision of International Criminal Court on this issue in Gaza?
I think the evidence that was presented by the South African team was brilliantly presented and was utterly persuasive. And the court did what it could. It could not order a ceasefire because it has jurisdiction only over states, and Hamas is not a state. And so it could not order a ceasefire. But it ordered an end to the genocide. It ordered an end to the massacres. It ordered an end to the deprivation starvation campaign. It ordered a restoration of humanitarian assistance. And it gave Israel time to do this. Now, Israel will have to report back to the court what it did. And I don't think it has done anything except continue the genocidal conduct that the court condemned it for. So I think the court will then reach a conclusion. Instead of talking about plausible genocide, there are grounds for us to consider this case, they will have to confront the fact that there is genocide taking place. At that point, the UN Security Council will be asked to enforce the court's decision, and the United States will be on the spot. Do we condone genocide, continue to protect it, or do we follow the rule of law and the international court's ruling? It will be an interesting moment.
How do you see the position of Netanyahu right now? The day after October 7th, all Israelis were so united behind him. Right now, how do you see his position?
I think it's quite shaky. Israel has not accomplished any of its military objectives in Gaza. It has not eliminated Hamas. It has driven the Palestinians into a concentration in the south, which it's now attacking. It has lost the moral argument internationally. It has lost the law case at the World Court. It has alienated the entire world. It has brought the Abraham Accords, by which it had normalized relations with some Arab countries, into disrepute and jeopardy. I don't see that it has accomplished anything other than bringing opprobrium upon itself. So Mr. Netanyahu has not freed the hostages. There's only one hostage who has been liberated by the Israeli armed forces. The only hostages who have been released were pursuant to an Israeli agreement with Hamas. Hamas retains its authority in Gaza and has gained vast popularity in the Arab world more generally, and in the West Bank of Palestine, where, of course, there are pogroms going on, an effort to expel Palestinians from their homes. This is all part of a broad effort. Mr. Netanyahu has made it very clear. The phrase that Israel should have sovereignty from the river to the sea was not a Palestinian invention. This is in the charter of Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party, and it's a phrase he's used publicly, and he's in saying there will be no Palestinian state. Now, Israelis probably, for the most part, don't support a Palestinian state. The world does. The Arab world insists on it. The Saudis have just declared that they will not normalize relations with Israel until there is a Palestinian state with a capital in East Jerusalem and the 1967 borders restored. And now this is very definitive. So all this wishful talk about, you know, Saudi normalization, blah, 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 that Mr. Blinken is talking about is aimed at American campaign donors. It's not serious diplomacy. And never was. Public opinion in the Arab world has turned decisively against normalization with Israel. So Mr. Netanyahu has accomplished the end of the process, the peace processes that had begun to achieve acceptance for Israel in its own region. And I don't know what will happen now, but I think the damage he's done will live after him. I suspect that there will be regime change in Jerusalem.
What would be the alternative for his government, for his party? And why we don't have any alternative in Israel?
Well, the alternative apparently is a group of zealots, fanatics, racists, who are utterly delusional in their view of what the world will accept. So the settler mentality has taken over in Israel, and it's completely unrealistic. Israel is the only country in the world that has apparently believed that security requires you to hold a gun on all of your neighbors. You don't try to make friends with them. You don't try to cooperate with them. You don't try to reduce the threat. You try to fend off the threat by periodically bombing and strafing them, violating their sovereignty, assassinating their officials, and so forth. This is a very, very defective, losing strategy. And Mr. Netanyahu has brought it to a head. So I don't know what replaces him. There are many very decent people in Israel. And unfortunately, a great number of them have now emigrated. There have been 500,000 people who have left Israel since October 7, at least. I don't think they're coming back. And, you know, the danger, the problem has been that anybody who said to Israel, as I have said, look, you're making a mistake. It's just like talking to an alcoholic as he begins to get into his car. You say, you're drunk. You shouldn't be driving a car. I'm going to take your keys away. Well, if you do that with Israel, they say you're an anti-Semite. No, you're not. You're trying to help them. It's constructive criticism, but they won't accept it. So I think one of the other things that's happened is a great part of the international Jewish population outside Israel, in my country, the United States, has the largest Jewish population in the world, larger than Israel. A great number of American Jews, European Jews, Latin American Jews are now alienated from Israel. They don't want to be associated with it. I mean, who wants to be associated with the cruelties that the Israeli army is inflicting on Palestinians? This is a disgrace. It's unacceptable. And so we have brave, young, mostly young, Jews in outside Israel who have taken the lead in protesting what Israel's doing. They don't want to be associated with it. I think the damage will be permanent. Israel has depended on international Jewish communities for its support, both political and economic. I don't think it's going to have that level of support in the future.
Conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine, are they hurting Biden in terms of his position in his popularity in the United States for 2024?
Yes, and I think for many reasons, we're very likely to see the re-election of Donald Trump. It's not only that Mr. Biden's mental capacity is obviously limited now, but, you know, however Ukraine turns out, either it will be yet another forever war condemned by progressives because it was foolish and led nowhere except to the humiliation of the West, or if Ukraine surrenders, which it may, it will be the Republicans will say, well, you see, Biden didn't give them enough aid, even though they are the ones obstructing the aid. In the case of Gaza, I think the moral arguments have been lost. The constituencies that Mr. Biden depended upon for his election, whether the young people, the people of color, African Americans, Hispanics, others, are very turned off by his handling of this issue. And there's no enthusiasm for his reelection. But beyond that, there's no actually opposition to it among many Democrats. There's no alternative to him, of course, which is why Mr. Trump is likely to be reelected. I note that in Nevada recently, there was a primary, and Mr. Trump wasn't on the ballot. Nikki Haley ran in the Republican primary, and the vote was for none of the above, not her. I think in Brazil, many years ago, in Rio de Janeiro, Brazilians elected the hippopotamus as mayor because the candidates were not seen as acceptable. I think Americans might vote for a hippopotamus now rather than Trump and Biden. But in default of a candidate like that, Mr. Trump is very likely to be reelected, and the world is hedging against that.
I want to talk about the Democratic Party, but I'm going to ask it later. If Trump wins, what does it mean for Ukraine and for Gaza?
Well, for Ukraine, it's very clear. He said he will end the war right away. 24 hours, he said. He'll call Vladimir Putin and reach an agreement to end the war. And as I suggested earlier, this will have to be on Russian terms. You know, 500,000 dead Ukrainians later, Ukraine will have been reduced to a smaller size, humiliated, decimated industrially, and it may or may not be able to get into the EU, but it's not going to get into NATO. So nothing will have been gained. If Mr. Trump is elected, as I expect he probably will be, I don't know what he'll do about Gaza. He was very subservient to Israel in his first term. You know, he went out of his way, moved the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. He recognized the illegal Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, brokered the so-called Abraham Accords. He set as a major objective normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. On the other hand, he has been quoted as saying that he's lost all faith in Mr. Netanyahu and the Israelis, that they really don't want peace. They want more land. They want more power. They want more money. They don't want the peace that we all hoped and believed they did. So perhaps he's had a revelation, and who can say what he will do? The one thing you can say about him is that he's consistently erratic.
When it comes to bombing Iran, Biden was not willing to do that. There were a lot of people advocating for this, Lindsey Graham and the other, a bunch of Republicans mostly were talking about this bombing Iran. But by the Biden administration, it seems to me that they didn't like it. But when it comes to Trump and his administration, do you think that the Netanyahu administration would be able to convince him? We remember that when he was in office and John Bolton was trying so hard to do this, he didn't like it.
I think it's very hard to say what Mr. Trump would do. A great deal of it depends, as I suggested, on the nature of his relationship with the government in Jerusalem. I don't know what government that will be. I can't imagine Mr. Netanyahu will still be in power. I think from the American military point of view, and from the point of view of sensible people generally, a war with Iran would be a disaster. It's not that Iran, you know, is militarily all that formidable, but they do have the capacity to shut down the Strait of Hormuz and thereby shut down the world oil supply and give a heart attack to the global economy. I think one thing about that's very clear about Iran is Iran is an ancient country with a very clear sense of its own historical and cultural distinctions. the preservation of your culture is the supreme interest of any country, and Iran will make huge sacrifices for this. And there may be dissidents in Iran, many people who don't like the Islamic Republic, or who are, for one reason or another, they're an ethnic minority, or they're religious dissidents, or they just don't like Walayat al-Faqih, you know, the rule of clerics. There are many people in Iran who are currently opposed to the regime, but they would rally behind it if Iran was attacked. So, I mean, Iranian nationalism, Persian nationalism is a reality. And if you invoke it, you know, the previous experiences of the United States in invading other countries, if we tried to do that with Iran, would be dwarfed by the resistance we would encounter. So I don't think the U.S. military has any enthusiasm at all for this. People who are interested in economic prosperity globally and in the United States don't have any enthusiasm for it. And you have a few warmongering fools, who some of whom you named, who don't understand this and just shoot off their mouths and don't know what they're talking about. I don't think the danger of a war with Iran is very great, in part because Iran doesn't want a war. And Iran is actually a restraining force with regard to all of these supposed agents that it has, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, Iraqi Shia militaries, militias. Iran doesn't want these parties to create a war. That's one of the reasons Hezbollah has been as cautious as it has been. It's one of the reasons Syria has been as cautious as it has been. So you start a war with Iran and you will get all of these forces aiming at Israel and the United States, and that would not be wise. So I don't think Iran wants a war. I think they try to restrain others from starting one. And I think, therefore, the chances of a war with Iran are not very great.
Just to wrap up this session, I want to talk about the Democratic Party and the future of this party. We know that Bernie Sanders joined the Democratic Party to do some changes within the Democratic Party, but he wasn't successful in doing that. Right now, the progressives are so unhappy with the situation of the Democratic Party. How do you see the future of this party?
What's happening in American politics is that the independents, non-party people, now outnumber the members of both parties. There is great disillusionment with both parties. And the number of people who don't want to follow party directives is increasing. That's true of the Democrats. A great number of people are disillusioned by their performance. Many on the Republican side are disillusioned with the extremism that the primary system and gerrymandering of districts has produced. We see a Congress that is paralyzed. We see a Supreme Court that is not in tune with the mood of the country on many issues. And we see a president who is beleaguered, really, not able to accomplish much of his program. Would that change Mr. Trump's election? I doubt it. The question is really, and I've said this before to you, I know, whether we're not back in a period like the 1850s, when the party structure broke down and a new party with a new cause, namely the Republican Party, with an anti-slavery platform, arose. I think we are very ripe for such a thing to happen, but it's not clear yet when and if it will. Clearly, Bernie Sanders is not acceptable to the center of our American politics, but he has quite a following on the left. Clearly, I would say people like Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley or you mentioned Lindsey Graham, are not acceptable to many Republicans. And they're certainly not acceptable to the center. Well, this is an invitation for someone to organize a new party. And I think we may see that, but not in time to save us this year from the results of the 2024 election.
We've seen this alternative in RFK Jr., Bobby Kennedy. When it comes to Gaza, he's totally in line with the mainstream media. Why he's doing this?
I have to say, I don't know the answer to that question, but I assume that he has strong backing from a few Jewish plutocrats who are insistent that he support Israel regardless of what Israel does. So while on other foreign policy questions, he is very independent, on this issue, he is very subservient to Israel, won't break ranks with Israel. So he's sort of a prisoner of the Zionist lobby, if you will. Whether he believes what he says or not, I don't know. In any event, the mainstream media have savaged him, tried very hard to discredit him, in part because he does not conform to their views, except on this Israel issue, where he's also been accused of being an anti-Semite, and he seems to be somewhat sensitive to that. In any event, he's not going to get elected, but he is an indication of general dissatisfaction on the part of the public with the current party structure, which buttresses the point I made earlier, that we are approaching a moment when the existing party structure is likely to disappear.
Tucker Carlson was in Moscow interviewing Putin. We had a lot of reactions in the mainstream media in the West. Newsweek was talking about sanctioning Tucker Carlson. We've heard Zelensky various times during this conflict in Ukraine. Why we cannot have Putin and his opinion? What's the problem with the mainstream media and their monopoly? It seems some sort of monopoly. They don't want to hear what the opposition are talking about.
This is a big problem in our democracy, not just in the United States. The insistence on political correctness, that if you disagree with my opinion, you are some kind of morally depraved person, and I won't listen to you. In fact, I think we all run into this problem. You cite a piece of information, and if it's from an undesirable source, even though it's correct, it's ruled out of order. In other words, the source is more important than the information. And I think Tucker Carlson, he's a complicated person, but he's quite independent-minded. I'm glad he interviewed Mr. Putin. I look forward to seeing the interview. I thought his interview with Viktor Orban was very enlightening. I mean, not that I agree with Mr. Orban, but at least I got some insight into how he's thinking. And I think we lose a great deal by excessive deference to monopoly opinion, as you put it. Your own international shows, your own programs, have a currency and a following precisely because monopoly media, oligopoly media, will not entertain views that are out of line with whatever the government narrative is. Mr. Carlson is very independent. He does not toe the line. In fact, he got fired from top Fox News for that reason. So I'm hopeful that he conducted a skillful and informative interview with President Putin, and I look forward to hearing it.